Evening, I want to start slightly differently than we have been. Something else coming in, come in. Hi there, there's another seat just in front of me here. There's always that. Just to publicly humiliate you. There's another one over there. Really, we should pass you over the crowd. Yes, I'd like to start a little bit differently tonight. In a way, tonight is the crux of the whole seminar. Everything that we've been talking about thus far is made spiritually relevant, complete by this evening's by the principle this evening of spiritual rebirth. Buddhist practice, the spiritual life itself, is not just about being a happy, healthy human being. It's not just about being integrated. It's not just about being emotionally positive. It's not just about letting go of selfishness, although all of those things, of course, are central to spiritual life. We're doing all of that so that we can move from the mundane path to the transcendental path, to go from the world to beyond the world, to turn away from samsara and embrace nirvana. That's why all of those things are being done. They're not being done just as ends in themselves, in a sense. In a sense they are, in a sense they're not. So tonight we're going to be exploring spiritual rebirth. What happens as we go on, there's, in a way, it's more and more difficult to talk accurately or even half accurately, partly because I haven't had enough experience to be able to talk about it. Really, from spiritual death onwards, it should only be the Buddha talking about it, or at least one of his enlightened disciples. So you've just got me, I'm afraid. I want to sort of explore what I mean by moving from the mundane to the transcendental. They're rather grand words. I want to be clear what I mean about moving from the world to beyond the world, from moving away from samsara to embracing nirvana later on in the evening. But as usual, I want us to start with our experience, as much experience as we've got. In a way, one of the things we can do as we go on in the spiritual life is share our experience and between us make the enlightened disciple, if this doesn't mean, by adding up all of our experiences of whatever goes beyond limited self-interest, whatever goes beyond selfishness, any little moment we've had, and we've probably all had glimmerings of moments, we're probably not able to live in those moments or even live from those moments, but perhaps if we could gather them all up together, we might make an enlightened disciple, who knows. Yeah. So what I'd like you to do first is start to reflect on any experience you've had that goes somewhat beyond yourself, that is not your usual everyday self. It's not usually the mind that you habituate towards. Something that seems to have within it something beyond yourself. I don't mean a literal beyond, I don't mean contact with some deity or anything like that. I don't mean anything supernatural. But I also don't mean anything just to do with me, to do with even me in my sense of underlying depth and so on. I mean a taste of something that seems to transcend you. It seems to shine through you and at the same time transcend you. It seems to complete you even and transcend you in that moment. So as I'm talking, I want you to sort of start to think about any experience you've had for which you can't completely explain, that doesn't quite fit into the history of your life, into the story of your life, into who you've decided you are, into the habit of being me. And it can be very small things, very subtle things. It doesn't have to be anything very shattering. But something perhaps it brought you here in the first place. Perhaps it made you ask questions of life, deeper questions of life. Something more than you usually experience. You might have even experienced it here. You might have experienced it. I remember when I first came into this room 26 years ago on a Wednesday night, I remember being incredibly struck by the figure of the Buddha, which I remember just thinking, how ridiculous, I've got one of those things, I've got a great big golden Buddha. I thought it, at the same moment, I seemed to think it ridiculous and wonderful. Incredible at the same time. And I almost couldn't bear to look at it. And I didn't know what my feeling was about it. Something I hadn't sort of planned for. I'd just come along to learn meditation, which seemed to me a sensible thing to try to do, to make myself feel happier, healthier person. I hadn't planned for this, you know what I mean? And I hadn't expected this strange contrariety I experienced in relationship to it, a sort of sense of how silly, how old-fashioned, how obvious to have this image, golden image of a figure, and at the same time, strangely, how wonderful to have it, to have this figure here. So I don't know, it might have been your contact, something happened here, it might be something that happened on retreat, if you've been on retreat, it might be your experience of the natural world. It might be your experience of a communication that seemed to go beyond the two of you, where more seemed to happen than the mere passing across of words. And what I'd like you to do, as usual, is in a group of four or so, just see whether you can share any of that. And you might not have any. I think we all probably have them, but there's such glints and glimmers from beyond that we hardly see them before they're gone, and then you very easily doubt their veracity, you very easily doubt whether you saw anything. In fact, it's so easy to lose them. People can sometimes have very strong experiences of whatever lies beyond us, as it were. All of these are, by the way, highly metaphorical ideas. The deeper you go, the fuller you go into metaphor. So I don't mean a literal beyond. But some people have very strong experiences, what we could call vision experiences, of something that lies beyond them, or seems to lie beyond them, something more than them, something that transcends them, but then they just forget them. They get washed away in the daily round of experience. So I want us to just spend a bit of time, if we can, talking about even a glimpse of those experiences. And then what I'd like to do is do a short meditation, and I'd like us to do a puja together, a short puja. Some of you may not have done this, a ritual. Can you just put your hand up if you've never done a puja, just so I know? Yeah, okay. So I won't explain the ritual because in a way they're not really explainable. But they're trying to open us up to something that goes beyond us, that transcends us, something more to life, which we so easily want to say either exists literally as an objective out there, and Buddhism and the Buddha is saying that's not true, or we're saying it doesn't exist, it's just a figment of my imagination, and that's not true either. We're wanting to open up a space between yes and no, between the yes of religion and the no of scepticism, of scientific materialism. In a way, I think Buddhism, above all, opens up that space between yes and no, between the no of, as I say, scientific materialism and the yes of theistic religion, of salvationist religion. We're trying to open up a whole other world that goes beyond yes and no. And the puja is trying to evoke that. But to prepare for the puja, I'm going to lead us in an imaginative meeting with the Buddha. because the Buddha represents more than anything in Buddhist tradition, a symbol for this space above and beyond, endlessly above and beyond yes and no. This new world of experience that's open to us, that shines into us, but doesn't really belong to us. Especially it doesn't belong to our ego identity, to our self identity, to ourself. So I'm going to lead us in an imaginative meeting with the Buddha. And I'd like, if you can, to try to hold an image, a sense, a feeling of the Buddha during the puja, during the short puja, it's not very long. And then I'm going to start us in a mantra. Some of you have done it before, which just represents, which is basically saying the Buddha's name, Shakyamuni. Muni Shakyamuni, it just means his name, the Muni, the teacher of the Shakyans. And what I'd like us to do as we do this mantra is see whether we can imagine it, and remember, folks, it's as if we're not doing anything anything literal this evening. Literal things have been left behind by now. We're trying to enter into a fully developed imaginative sense of meeting the Buddha, of coming into contact with a tune beyond us, as Wallace Stevens puts it, a sense of the beyond. Yeah. So see if you can, during the mantra, feel your way towards a meeting with the Buddha, and I'll lead us through a sort of imaginative process of that. And don't worry too much about whether you can see an image or not, that's not very important. You might just imagine someone near you. You might just imagine that in the room, instead of me and the other order members, instead of this sort of gold figure, there is the Buddha himself. And you wouldn't need to look at him, you wouldn't need to think about him. All you'd need to do is just be open to this incredible presence, this atmosphere. Yeah. So let's try to do that during the mantra. By the end of the mantra, we'll then go and have the obligatory cup of tea. Okay, so let's just turn towards our friends in groups of four and see whether you can find anything that speaks to what I was saying. So setting yourself up for meditation. As soon as you're ready, closing your eyes. And just noticing how that short discussion has left you just now. See if you can take your attention down into your heart center and notice what any sensations, any feelings that you feel there in the center of your chest. And just being willing to feel whatever you do feel, even if that's nothing very much. It's already there. Just a question of taking your heart down into your, taking your head rather, down into your heart. And then with your mind exploring your heart center, just bring to mind, if you can, the experiences that you were talking about, of something that seemed to go somewhat beyond you, that seemed to suggest there's more to life than we think, there's more to life than we know, and that might just be an experience or the memory of an experience, just a glimpse of something beyond us. And allowing yourself to trust the truth of that experience, that it is pointing to something, that it is suggesting something about life, about the potentialities in life that go beyond us. Everything that's truly interesting goes beyond ourselves. And imagining this feeling of being in contact with the potentials of life, with the mysteries of life even. Imagining that feeling opening out, becoming more and more stable, more and more trusted. And then imagining that sense of more to life, of more life, of greater life beyond us. Imagining that being the Buddha himself. That you're in touch with the Buddha himself. And this presence, you might be able to see him or just imagine him near you, and just imagine a heart connection with him. His presence is endlessly wise, endlessly kind. And being in touch with him gives you this incredible sense of reassurance. That you're all right here now. You're safe. The things that frighten you are just dreams. See if you can keep in touch with that sense of connection through the puja. See if you can deepen into it during the mantra, imagining that the mantra is calling the Buddha closer and closer to you. Threefold puja, opening reverence. We reverence the Buddha.
We reverence the Buddha.
The perfectly enlightened one.
The perfectly enlightened one.
The shower of the way.
The shower of the way.
We reverence the Dharma.
We reverence the Dharma.
The teaching of the Buddha.
The teaching of the Buddha.
Which leads from darkness to light.
Which leads from darkness to light.
We reverence the Sangha.
We reverence the Sangha.
The fellowship of the Buddha's disciples.
The fellowship of the Buddha's disciples.
That inspires and guides.
That inspires and guides.
Reverence to the three jewels. We reverence the Buddha.
We reverence the Buddha.
And aspire to follow him.
And aspire to follow him.
The Buddha was born as we are born.
The Buddha was born as we are born.
What the Buddha overcame.
What the Buddha overcame.
We too can overcome.
We too can overcome.
What the Buddha attained.
What the Buddha attained.
We too can attain.
We too can attain.
We reverence the Dharma.
We reverence the Dharma.
And aspire to follow it.
And aspire to follow it.
With body, speech and mind.
With body, speech and mind.
Until the end.
Until the end.
The truth in all its aspects.
The truth in all its aspects.
The path in all its stages.
The path in all its stages.
We aspire to study.
We aspire to study.
Practice.
Practice.
Realize.
Realize.
We reverence the Sangha.
We reverence the Sangha.
And aspire to follow it.
And aspire to follow it.
The fellowship of those who tread the way.
The fellowship of those who tread the way.
As one by one.
As one by one.
We make our own commitment.
We make our own commitment.
An ever widening circle.
An ever widening circle.
The Sangha grows.
The Sangha grows.
Offerings to the Buddha. Reverencing the Buddha.
Reverencing the Buddha.
We offer flowers.
We offer flowers.
Flowers that today are fresh and sweetly blooming.
Flowers that today are fresh and sweetly blooming.
Flowers that tomorrow are faded and fallen.
Flowers that tomorrow are faded and fallen.
Our bodies too, like flowers.
Our bodies too, like flowers.
Will pass away.
Will pass away.
Reverencing the Buddha.
Reverencing the Buddha.
We offer candles.
We offer candles.
To him who is the light.
To him who is the light.
We offer light.
We offer light.
From his greater lamp, a lesser lamp we light within us.
From his greater lamp, a lesser lamp we light within us.
A lamp of Bodhi.
A lamp of Bodhi.
Shining within our hearts.
Shining within our hearts.
Reverencing the Buddha.
Reverencing the Buddha.
We offer incense.
We offer incense.
Incense whose fragrance pervades the air.
Incense whose fragrance pervades the air.
The fragrance of the perfect life.
The fragrance of the perfect life.
Sweeter than incense.
Sweeter than incense.
Spreads in all directions.
Spreads in all directions.
Throughout the world.
Throughout the world.
Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha.
Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha
Yeah, so really good to see so many of you here in week 7. Quite something, really. So yeah, really nice to see you all. So what I want to do tonight is start again with the Buddha, this time with the Buddha rather than Siddhartha. So as I've been going through the seminar, I've been trying to keep relating the great stages of spiritual life to the life of the Buddha. The book that I'm writing, which I'm preparing by talking to you, you're my guinea pig. And they're nice guinea pigs. I used to have guinea pigs going. It's called The Journey and the Guide. And so when we talk about the journey of spiritual life, and I'm always wanting to say it is the journey, it's the journey of life in a way whether you like it or not. I said right at the beginning that human life is a spiritual question straight away. You've got within your life the great problem of death, the great problem of old age, if you're lucky, suffering and death. So that turns human life into a kind of koan. The one thing that you most don't want, you're going to get, and you don't know when. So it's not really that there's a spiritual life. I think that's I don't think that's true. I think that your human life is a spiritual life. The only question that we have is, do we want to engage with that or not? And so much of our life, so much of my life, is an unwillingness to engage with the spiritual life that your life presents you with, that life itself presents you with. So it's not really a question of, do you want to do one or not? It's not even a question of, do you want to be a Buddhist or not? It's really a question of, do you want to engage with the spiritual life you've already got, that you got the moment you were born? You were born with this spiritual life. All I need to decide is to cooperate with that great issue. And that Buddhism has the clearest vision of that issue and the most articulated response to it. And the guide, the Buddha, is the guide because he's the only one, or perhaps the first one is more correct, who travelled the whole journey and therefore can talk about each stage of the journey from his own experience without having to rely on ideas, on concepts, on theories. He can just say, well, this is what happens. Yeah? And his complete journey of spiritual life is just him utterly and completely committing himself to the spiritual life that his life was, just as our life is. There's no difference between us and Siddhartha in that sense. He saw that life was shot through with suffering. It ended in old age, sickness and death. And he also saw a potential of a genuine solution to that in what's called the fourth sight. We're in an analogous position. We may not have seen the fourth sight, but the first three sights present themselves to us all the time, in the mirror even. So are we going to engage with that great issue, the great problem of our life or not? That's what spiritual life is. It's not something ethereal, it's not something, in a way it's not something spiritual. I increasingly dislike this term. It feels otherworldly, rather vapid at times, rather too sweetened, rather too ethereal. It's much more like just engaging with your life. Yeah? So we've been following his journey, which is the exemplar of the journey, our journey. And I think I left him, as it were, when he said, flesh may wither up, blood may dry, but I'm going to gain enlightenment. So I was suggesting that that is, in a way, the greatest moment of spiritual death. And I'll come back to spiritual death in a minute, which is a stage of complete commitment to the great problem of life. An unwavering, wholehearted, complete commitment to the great problem of life and to finding the solution to the problem of life. Not to finding false solutions, not finding distractions, not finding half solutions, but the solution itself. That's what he said at that moment. He said, okay, here's the problem of life. I'm going to sit here and find the solution, or I'm going to die trying. So the stage of spiritual death is the stage of commitment, the stage of completely committing yourself to the issue of life, which you've already got. And then, you know, according to tradition, he gains enlightenment. I won't say what that means. I don't know what that means. No, but none of us do. You'd have to be enlightened to know. But I want to just talk about, try and be brief this time, talk about two, not very good at being brief, try and talk about two of the metaphors, of the images, of the sort of pictures that come down to us through the tradition. I've been feeling, I don't know whether it's just my age, possibly it is, but I've been feeling more and more how very accurate spiritual the Buddha's metaphors are. The metaphors, stories, similes, images, when you think about them deeply, are incredibly accurate. They're as accurate as philosophy. They're no softer than that. They're as tough and as accurate as philosophy, but in pictures, as it were. And this actually speaks to this whole quality of imagination, which I might touch on next week, which is that imagination is not a kind of soft, fluffy version of life. Meanwhile, some people do hard thinking. Imagination is like the philosophy of the whole being, the philosophy of the heart, but even that's too emotional, the philosophy of the person. And it's just as tough as literal philosophy, genuine imagination. When you unpack the images, you find an argument of the same toughness, robustness, rigour as a philosophical argument. Yeah. Schopenhauer, the great German philosopher, said that the arts were doing in concreto what philosophy was doing in abstracto. So philosophy was trying to talk about something in abstract, whereas art was trying to just show at you. Yeah. So that's what imagination is. It's trying to show at you rather than talk about it. So I want to just talk about these two images that have, for me, keep coming back to me, and that is images that, according to tradition, arise after the Enlightenment or as part of the Enlightenment experience. It doesn't really matter quite which. So the first is, according to the story, Siddhartha now is just sitting under a peepal tree, what's come down to be known as a Bodhi tree, a beautiful heart-shaped leaves, are very beautiful trees, and he was sitting there in meditation. According to tradition, he was doing the mindfulness of breathing, the very practice that you will have learnt when you came to the meditation, to the LBC. He was just watching his breath and just went deeper and deeper and deeper into life as it was directly experienced, not life as it was thought about and analysed, but into life itself. And then it started raining. The rains came. Now the rains in India are tremendous. They're not like English drizzle. This just goes on for days. There's sort of bleary half light of English drizzle. Even more Scottish drizzle, actually. It's very famous. Manchester drizzle is fairly bad, actually. But this, you have to imagine this incredible downpour of rain. And what happened is this great serpent appeared, a great snake, a huge snake like a python, a terrifying creature. And according to this story, this great serpent wound itself around the body of the Buddha. So there you are, you're sitting in meditation. And this huge python winds itself around you. Just have a bit of a feeling for that. And what this python does, it then opens out its hood and puts its hood over the meditating Buddha. And the Buddha just sits there in meditation. Sometimes, actually, you can see images of the Buddha with this great snake, this naga, as it's called, sort of dragon snake. I like to think of it simply as a sort of huge python. It's a cobra, sorry, yes. That's I don't like to think of it as a huge. Thank you. He does this all the time, at breakfast and everything. But no, that's what I'm imagining. I'm not imagining a python because they crush you. They kind of crush you to death, and I'm not. That's not the metaphor I'm trying to come up with. Okay, switch over to cobra. I'll just change onto cobra. Just press change all. Which you can do in a book, but you can't do when you're talking. Anyway, there you go. Yeah, a cobra, that's what I mean. So basically, the rain falls, and the rain is the Buddha is protected from the rain. And then when the rain stops, the cobra uncoils itself and magically transforms itself into a young prince. And the young prince then bows to the seated Buddha and disappears. Yeah. That's all it says. There's a Buddha meditating, stops a pour with rain, this vast cobra appears, winds itself around the Buddha, opens its hood above the Buddha's head. A cobra, a terrifying thing, not a python. And when the rain stops, the cobra uncoils itself, turns into a young prince, bows to the Buddha and disappears. Fantastic image that's come down through the centuries. Makes me think that sometimes these stories are much more likely to survive, aren't they, than the words. Like, you know, 37 Bodhiyangas, if there is 37. Is there 37? You know, the Eightfold Path even, you can't always rattle them off. But this story, that will stay, won't it? You only need to hear it once, and there it is, the story. So it's makes you wonder, doesn't it, but these stories have stayed, you see, because they light your mind up, that you don't need to try to remember them. And then the next story is Mara, whose actually name just means literally death. So death itself came to the Buddha and said, you know, this is supposed to be on the brink of enlightenment. Who are you to gain enlightenment? In other words, he tries to sow the last great seed of doubt in the Buddha's mind. And one of the things I was trying to sort of suggest earlier on is that we so easily doubt our experiences that go beyond ourselves. We live in a world that wants to dismiss them, that wants to rationalise them away, wants to find even scientific explanations for them. And that tradition of doubt has always been there. So this is the last great moment of doubt that this figure, Mara, death, says, you know, who are you to gain enlightenment? And according to the story, the Buddha just reaches down and touches the earth. Sometimes people leave it there, but that's not enough. He just touches the earth. It's supposed to be like a lightning bolt, his hand touching the earth. And as soon as he touches the earth goddess arises from the earth. I think it's striking when you think about it, because you've got a gendered pair here. You've got a python and a young prince, and now you have you've got a cobra. My change all button hasn't worked. You've got a cobra and a young prince, and then you've got this earth goddess arising out of the earth. She arises just up to her waist, and you know that's clearly clearly a symbol of all those procreative powers are the earth itself. What do you mean? So she rises up to her waist from the earth, and she says, she attests to the Buddha's experience. She says, no, he can gain enlightenment. I've watched him all this time. I've been here all this time. I've always been here. And I can attest to his practice. I can assure you that enlightenment is completely right just now. He will gain enlightenment because that's what must happen now. I attest to that. That's just how it has to be. You know, when a apple is ripe, it falls from the tree. The apple is ripe, it will fall from the tree. She's not saying, oh yes, with my support or anything. She's just saying, when an apple is ripe, it will fall from the tree. And that's what she attests to. And then she disappears. Yeah. So these are two wonderful images, I think, from the enlightened experience. And I think sometimes these images perhaps aren't made enough of. They're sort of more dramatic images, but around this experience. But this is, at least for me, very, very important. And for me, they represent the fact that enlightenment, full and perfect enlightenment, nirvana, is natural. It's to do with nature. It's to do with the nature of things. It's to do with how reality is, how it's structured, so that nature appears as a cobra, and that's nature, I think, in its incredible energy, which, and that energy is almost terrifying. It's incredible energy. It's interesting that in the Christian tradition, the snake has been so vilified. It was supposed to be condemned to crawl on its belly, wasn't it? Because it originally stood upright. It's difficult to think how. Let's not worry about that. Probably a bit of a relief. when you see a snake, I mean, when you've seen a large snake close up, when I was at Gukuloka, they weren't large, but it's quite a large green snake. And just go close to it, and you have this really strong sense of its otherness. It's so other to us. And so it's interesting, isn't it, how we want to demonize otherness. It frightens us. It's something beyond us, actually. It's nature, but it's a nature we can't recognize. It's got no limbs. It's got this forked tongue in it. And I remember seeing this snake, and it seemed to almost look back at me, as if it was aware of me. And they are, you know, if you get close to them, they'll go for you. If they think you're dangerous enough, they'll go for you, and they go for you very fast. They have that primordial terror to them, which is this incredible energy, and also this incredible otherness. So nature, in this sense of something other, and something incredibly energetic and dangerous, that energy of nature coils itself around the enlightened Buddha and protects him. A wonderful image of all of the energies of nature made, I don't want to say tame, because I don't think that's the right metaphor, but all the energies of nature now serving the enlightened experience, so much so that the hood of a cobra protects the rain from above his head. And then the second image is of this earth coming, arising as a goddess. I think this is a universal image. You see it in Norse mythology and German mythology. You see it, for instance, in Wagner's opera, Erda, the earth goddess, arises and attests. She's the one that sees everything. She's the one that's always there. She's been there before you, and she'll be there afterwards. So she's the one who sees everything just as it is. And she's not disgusted by anything. She's not... nothing... everything is just what it is. There's this lovely sutra where the Buddha says, well, when you spit on the earth isn't disgusted by it. It doesn't sort of throw it back. The earth just attests to everything as it is. It just is the earth. It just is there for what it is. Yeah? So the earth arises and says, yeah, this is the Buddha. He's part of nature. She's saying, really, we live in a universe, if she was trying to be more philosophical, which she wouldn't be, but she lives in a universe where apples fall from trees and Buddhas arise. And certain conditions have come about for this Buddha to arise now, so the Buddha will arise. I'm here to attest to that. The earth has seen that the tree has grown, the apples are ripe, and now the apple will fall. That's just how things are. Yeah? So both of these images are saying that enlightenment itself is part of the structure of nature, part of the law of things. It's not... so when I talk about moving from the world to beyond the world, I don't mean it literally. I don't mean that there is this world of apple trees and cars and cafes and people and meditation cushions, and then there's this other world of spiritual life. I don't mean it literally in that way. I mean it's this world transfigured. Excuse me. This world seen without greed, hatred or delusion is a sort of correct way of saying it, but that's not enough really. That doesn't really give you a feeling for it, because it sort of feels imaginable and it's not imaginable. But there is no other world, literally. It's this world transfigured by perfect wisdom. And that perfect wisdom is part of this world, in a certain sense. It's part of the nature of things. It's the deepest nature of things. So, that's what the Buddha was trying to say in his teachings afterwards. He was trying to say, when I look at things, there's a certain regularity to experience. It's patterned in a certain way. This is the law of Pratichasamutpada, which is the central doctrine of Buddhism, really. That all things arise in dependence on conditions. Apples and Buddhas arise in dependence on conditions. So last week I talked about the five niyamas, as they're apparently pronounced. Utu niyama, Bija niyama, and Manu niyama. They represent the physical, organic and inorganic and mind elements of our experience, you could say. They represent our physical self, the circulation of our blood, our fight and flight instincts, our genetic inheritance. They represent the kind of creature we are that can be discerned by the sciences, so that you can study what happens in the eye when you get frightened. You know that the blood goes from the major major organs of the Buddha of the body into the muscles, so that you can run away. You can study all that. Whether you believe in it or not, as soon as you get a horrible email from somebody or somebody drives too close to you in traffic, all that will kick off instinctively, and that's part of these three lower niyamas, as it's called. That's what they're trying to get at, that life is patterned in certain ways. When you're on your bike and a car comes too near to you, the patterning of life is such that fight or flight reflexes will just kick off naturally. Your eyes will dilate so you can see better. Your blood will move from the major organs into your muscles so you can get away, and so forth. So they're the elements of patterning which are discernible by the sciences, you know, apples falling, gravity, and so on. But the Buddha discovered two other ways in which that reality is patterned, which is that they're patterned in the sense of karma nirma, which is to do with a self-conscious subject and their experience. How experience appears under certain laws that govern the relationship between your mental state and your experienced life. So that if you're in a negative mental state, you see things in a jaundiced way. You see things in a constricted way. You'll tend to pick out and elaborate on the most negative readings of your experience. And you'll seem to see those things. So you'll see people against you. You'll see things getting in your way. You'll see things that don't take you into account. And the more you or I underline our negative mental states with views that make us believe in them, nobody likes me, I'm the subject, I'm oppressed by certain people, I'm oppressing certain people, etc., etc., the views that sort of make us, that sort of hold our negative sense of mind, we'll see life more and more in those terms. And the Buddha's saying this is a natural law. It's just like the law of gravity. When you're in a negative mental state, certain things, certain patternings in the universe appear. The sun doesn't seem to shine. People seem to dislike you quicker. Things don't seem to go your way. Life, it feels rather difficult and hard work. Just as when you're in a genuinely positive mental state, and I don't mean just a state of mind that's just up, a genuinely positive mental state, your mind is more expansive, naturally more expansive, isn't it? When you're in a negative mental state, your mind is contracted. But when you're in a positive mental state, your mind is more expansive. You seem to see more potentiality in life. You have literally more choice, because you can see more choices. You're more observant of things, you're more aware of the life around you, and so on. Yeah? And the Buddha was saying, well, this is just part of the nature of things. When you're in a positive mental state, the world appears in a certain way. Certain laws appear to you. And that the art of life, from the Buddhist point of view, is making use of this law of karma nirma processes. That there is a law in the universe which favours positive mental states and positive actions arising out of mental states. Favours them in the sense that life seems to open up. There seems to be more life when you do that. Yeah. Just as you know that when you're in a negative state of mind, life seems to close down. Your own experience seems to close down on yourself, on myself. Yeah. So those are karma nirma processes. They are natural processes in the world. You can try them out. You just be generous, and your experience of the world changes. It comes back to you in an enriched way, even if you didn't feel like being generous. One of the great things about generosity is you don't need to feel like it. You just act on it. You just be generous. I was saying earlier on in the seminar that without generosity, life doesn't work. I think generosity is the thing that makes life live. You can be very deep, you can be very intelligent, you can be wonderfully talented, but if you don't give, life doesn't kind of move. It doesn't live, it doesn't flourish. Even if you're quite bad in other ways, I'm trying to think of some ways that you could be bad. Having affairs comes to mind. Being a bit leery. If you're bad in other ways, that's not so important as this. It would be better to be generous and have lots of other shortcomings. In a way, it's a primary virtue. It's what makes life flourish, even if you're thoroughly disreputable in other ways. I'm sure you're not. I am a bit, but you're not. I was distracting myself now. I'm now thinking of ways I can be disruptive. So that's the law of karma nirma. Yeah? That's where it came from. You can try it out. So just be generous. Tomorrow, think, okay, let's just try and be generous. And see what happens to the universe, to your experience, to life, when you do that. Or when you remember that you've got lots to be grateful for. See what happens to life. It really is as simple as about the Buddha isn't teaching a theory, he's just saying try this and you'll observe this. On the basis of being generous, certain things arise. Yeah. On the basis of karma nirma, certain things arise. So that's our great task, and that really covers the first two great stages of the spiritual life. The stage of integration is mainly, well, you could think of it as getting to know those three lower nirmas as they exist in us. Getting to know the kind of creature I am, whether I'm an extrovert or an introvert, whether I need lots of time on my own or not so much time on my own, whether I need to have a creative part of life or whether I need to be exploring science. What kind of creature am I, and how does that creature flourish? You need to learn that about yourself. I need to learn that about myself. There is a way in which you flourish, and a lot of that's to do with your basic character traits, your personality shape, your psychic shape, your underlying genetic loading and so on. And that's to do with the three lower nirmas. Yeah? And that's all taken into account by the practice of integration. And that practice of integration needs to carry on deepening and deepening. We keep needing to integrate more and more. As we practice, it's not something that's literally left behind, but if we imagine it as a journey, then we need to, on the basis of knowing ourselves, on the basis of knowing what kind of creature we are, we need to give, we need to activate this great law of karma nirma processes, that on the basis of positive mental states, positive volitions, as I was emphasising earlier on, a whole new world appears. A world that is more satisfying, enriching, aesthetically pleasing. It feels like it's going somewhere. When you're in a really genuinely positive state of mind, you feel like your life is going somewhere. You don't feel stuck anymore. You feel like life is opening up. You feel there's more to do, in the very positive sense. Yeah? And that's activating this law of karma nirma. But the stage of spiritual life, spiritual death, is then going beyond that. Most of what we can do is activate this law of karma nirma. We're using self to go beyond self. I found something Sangharakshita said about tantric Buddhism where they say you use the dirt to go beyond the dirt. Which is a very tantric way of putting it. You use the dirty self to clean away the dirty self, if you know what I mean. That's what karma nirma is doing. You're trying to use self to attenuate your self-clinging. Every time you act generously, every time you act especially unselfishly, you attenuate, you thin, you lessen your self-clinging, you lessen your self-interest. As soon as you act just a tiny bit generously, in that moment you've, to a degree, attenuated your self-interest. Just making a cup of tea for people in the office, in that busy moment, you know, when everyone gets busy in the office and everybody kind of does that clamp down on the screen and everyone gets a bit irritable slightly, you can feel this sort of look, we've got lots to do moment where everyone sort of tightens up. What you need to do in that moment is say, anybody like a tea? And suddenly you can change that world immediately, just as you're locked into it thinking, you know, I've got to get through this. Use that moment thinking, would anybody like a cup of tea? How about I make a cup of tea? And you'll feel everybody, not just you, well, everyone will change. They'll remember that there's this life as well as this locking on to their emails. So just sort of, that's what the karma nirma processes do. They attenuate our self-interest. But they never take it away. And if you're not careful, there's a danger of getting stuck in a more and more refined self-interest. And this is gets more dangerous as you practice spiritual life, because you get better at making things comfortable for you at a certain level. You get better at getting things your own way, even in your own way, in a sort of nice spiritual way, which is just your own way, actually. It's just with a bit more sugar. Do you see what I mean? In a certain sense, it gets more dangerous. You can sort of become... You become much more... It's sort of likeable in a certain sense. You sort of run into life much more smoothly, and it's tempting to sort of park up there. And of course, when you park up, all that happens, to mix metaphors, you sort of gradually decay until you start. Anyway, never mind. You park up. So there needs to, we need to use self to start to see beyond self clinging. But spiritual death is when we do start to have intimations of what lies beyond self-clinging, what lies beyond self-interest. You see, we need to thin self-interest so as to see that self is actually an illusion. This self that we've been so protecting and so frightened of losing, so wanting to enhance, that very self is an illusion. It's not that we need to sacrifice it, there just isn't one there. It's a construct. We've constructed it, and then we've protected it. So we need to use karma nirma processes to use self, to go beyond self, to see that this self-cherishing is based on a fundamental delusion that there is such a thing. And when we see that there isn't such a thing, we die. That's why spiritual death is... It's very, very important that it is spiritual death. You literally die. Your ego sense has to die. It can't be refined away. It has to die. And I was saying this a few weeks ago, this is a stage of commitment, the stage of realising that to see through self, you need to commit yourself to spiritual life. And I was saying it's not a practice, it's a decision. And I think that's true. But you can think of it as a practice. And it's a practice of selflessness. It's a practice of being less selfish. So you could say that the stage of spiritual death is the stage of being unselfish. Sangharakshita was once asked how you know you make spiritual progress. And he just said, all you need to know is whether you're a little bit less selfish than you were. If you can look back and you think, I'm a little less selfish than I was, then you've made spiritual progress. I really like that because it's not at all technical. It doesn't involve five niyamas, it doesn't involve even pratitya samuppada. It's just saying, have a look at your life. If you're a bit less selfish, then you've made some spiritual progress. But when we start to see through self, when we start to see through the delusion of self, that's what spiritual rebirth is trying to get to. Because if we're not careful, we think that we're losing something. That spiritual life is all about this self that we've got, which we've sort of got to get rid of, as if it really is there and it's a problem. As if self has to be sacrificed, almost, in the Christian sense. There isn't a self to sacrifice. You see what I mean? That there isn't. We just got it wrong. We're just mistaken about our situation. I mean, mistaken about our situation in the deepest possible sense, but we're just mistaken. There isn't something to be sacrificed. There isn't something we've got that we're going to lose. But if we're not careful from this point of view, looking at the spiritual life from this point of view, all we can see is a fire that we have to walk into. And in that fire, we die. All we can see, all we can see is the cobra. Something terrifying. Something with that flickering tongue with those green eyes. All we can see is something terrifying, something that's moving towards us, something that's going to wrap itself around us. Yeah? So we recoil. But from this point of view, all we can see is that we don't see the earth goddess. We don't see that the apple is ripe and can fall now. So the spiritual death is looking at the same experience from the point of view of our unenlightened self. It's the cobra that we're going to meet. It's the fire that we're going to have to walk into. But as we walk into that fire, something completely new is born. Something completely new is born. The most accurate way of saying it, perhaps, is a stream of suprapersonal energy arises. There is volition after you walk through the fire, but it's not self-volition. It's not self-interested volition. There is just an arising of non-self-based volition, if you mean. And that non-self-based volition is experienced by others as compassion. It's not even that you're being compassionate, it's just that other people experience that arising, that suprapersonal force that seems to arise in you, even a suprapersonal spirit or consciousness which goes beyond you, which is active. That's why the word consciousness seems important. It's active, intelligent, but it's not your activity and it's not your intelligence. It's not also God's activity or God's intelligence either. It's something beyond that yes and no. Yeah? So that's what the stage of spiritual rebirth is trying to elucidate in us. And without it, the spiritual life doesn't make sense. Without it, spiritual life just does look like just annihilation, doesn't it? And I know a lot of people are fearful about this, that Buddhism is just leading to a kind of self-annihilation, you know, I can't even say that word, self-destruction. That you will just die, and that, what's the point of that? that you're left without a self, you're left without everything that you cherish most. But out of that death, something is reborn. Actually, that's happening on a much lower level every time we act in a certain sense. Every time I'm generous when I don't want to be, out of that death of selfishness, a tiny, tiny particle of death of selfishness, arises a tiny particle of rebirth, doesn't it? That moment where you want to just get angry with someone and you choose not to and just say, what's going on here? You know, I don't know, I don't understand where we are just now. But you choose not to retaliate. You choose not to harm. You choose not to assert your egotism again. In that moment of death, which is a death of the ego, something new arises. And it has always this slightly miraculous sense. I don't mean it in a Christian sense, obviously, but there's something new arising, something unplanned, unwanted, unexpected arises. Something new arises. The Buddha and the stages of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth are that at its most complete, where self, you just step off self, and as you fall, the angel comes into being, if it were. As you fall, the phoenix arises. An arising of non-self volition, but a force, a spirit, a superpersonal force that seems to, as it were, work through you. Complete you and work through you. The image that I find most, I don't know whether I've managed to communicate, the image that I find most telling of this experience actually comes from the Christian tradition. So remember, folks, I'm reading this from my spiritual life here at the centre, not from my religious upbringing. But it's the image of the Annunciation in the tradition, in the Christian tradition. And when I say this, I think actually I mean certain paintings of that I've seen. I think sometimes artists are in touch with the imaginative potential of that image rather than the theological meaning of that image. That's why those images sometimes say more than anything to do with the miraculous birth of the Virgin and the nature of the angels and the nine levels of angels and all these sort of theological technicalities. The artist, it is for her most inspired, touches the imaginative meaning of the image that goes beyond the theological Christian meaning of the image. And it's that kind of imaginative meaning I want that touches me. So I remember, Jan Bosch and I, a few of us, we went to Florence to look at all these paintings. We went on sort of on a painting holiday and we just looked at paintings. In fact, we looked at paintings for a long time. Some of my friends were slightly horrified how long they were supposed to stand there and look at the same thing. And that's what you need to do. You need to just stand there for ages, much, much longer than you think. A quarter of an hour is quite a brief look at a painting. We're thinking at least half an hour. So you can't look at many. And we were looking at these paintings, and I just became more and more struck by these images of the Annunciation. So in the images of the Annunciation, you have the Virgin Mary. Don't worry, folks, the Virgin Mary, there she is, usually clothed in blue. The Virgin Mary, capital V. And then you have the Annunciating Angel coming to tell her that she's now pregnant with the Christ child, with Christ. That's the sort of... I can't remember the Latin. I wasn't a Catholic, so I can't remember what the angel says. But the angel basically says, you're now pregnant with the Christ child, yeah? The divine child, yeah? So I personally find that a wonderful metaphor. I was never a Catholic, so it's never been a problem for me. I was brought up in the Church of England, and the Virgin Mary is sort of Tippex out, or sort of emptied out. She's played only a very small bit part in salvation. She's been removed for religious reasons many, many years before. So I've never had a problem with the Virgin Mary. So When you look at these paintings, the best of them, I think, really exemplify this issue of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, especially this issue of spiritual rebirth, rebirth being the metaphor. And we are in this world very much in metaphors. So, in one by Simone Martini, very early Renaissance painter, the angel is a bit like an angel. If you imagine that, I keep wanting to say python, what is it again?
Cobra.
Remember that cobra turned into an angel. The angel's like that. It's got this kind of glittering dangerousness to it. It's got, if you look at it for long enough, it's got this incredible kind of energy, this sort of almost like the light of the angel is almost prickly. This sort of incredible kind of energy. It's like a dynamo of energy that's just erupted into this room. And the Virgin is sort of, it's just too much for the Virgin. She's sort of, actually not so well painted, actually, she's sort of moving away, horrified almost by this sort of force that's appeared in the world. Yeah. In another one by Botticelli, the angel is much less threatening, not quite, a little bit more like the earth goddess. Not quite, but a little bit more like that. Much less threatening, but again with this incredible sense of rushing into the room, that it, in a moment it's just suddenly appeared. Interestingly, in Leonardo's one, Annunciation, they're very evenly matched, so that the angel is a bit like an angel version of the Virgin. She's not at all frightened. She's just sitting there very, very calmly. And the angel, it's very similar to it, except that the angel has these huge wings. But there's a kind of meeting, almost of equals, not quite, but almost. Yeah. I'm trying to think of it. There's another one that came into my mind. But see, what's interesting when you look at a few is that this idea, this central, this moment is imagined in very, very different ways. Yes, that's right. In Fra Angelico's, the angel and the Virgin look like twins. It's weird. They quite clearly look like brother and sister. They actually look alike. And their postures it's actually the National Gallery, go and see it, it's lovely. The postures actually exactly mirror each other. They're like twin brothers and sister, like identical twins almost, except for their brother and sister. So which is talking about the androgyny of the experience. Except for the angel is sitting on the grass outside and the grass doesn't bend. Of course, it's got these beautiful wings. So this is for me. Sorry to use a Christian image, but there you go. It's my turn. For me, it represents spiritual rebirth, something new breaking into the. They're often actually inside a little room, or the angel is in the garden, but the Virgin's in the room. The room, the house, the garden—they always represent the mind, just like the palace in the Buddha's story represents. This enclosure of me, this walled citadel of me, and into that palace, into that room, into that walled garden, something new arises. Something that is in life. The problem with the angels, of course, is their association with the supernatural and so forth. But something natural, something with wings, yes, but something that arises, erupts into life. It's an attempt. It's a human attempt to imagine the new arising. Breaking in to the cautionary house of our being, to the small house, to the narrow house of being, erupting into it and disrupting it. The Virgin then represents us at our most developed, represents us at the peak of karma nirma processes. It suddenly sounds so horribly technical, but. At our purest, the metaphor of virginity is perfect, actually. It's like virgin snow. So that the new, what's beyond the self, can completely change the self. And then something is born. In that moment, something new comes into being. The divine child appears. Highly metaphorical, and of course these images predate Christianity. They were co-opted into Christianity. And actually, many Christians, including St. Paul, which is, St. Paul is Christianity really, was very dubious about angels. He wanted to get rid of them because you wouldn't know whether people were talking to angels or devils. So he was keen to get rid of them. But you know that you can't get rid of angels from Christianity. The Virgin represents ourselves at the peak of karma nirma processes, where we're most like snow, where we're most receptive. One of the things I haven't been able to talk about in the seminar is this stage of spiritual receptivity. I'll come on to it next week. But when we're completely open to life erupting into the small house of egotism, yeah, where we're open to something beyond ourselves, from ourselves, if you know what I mean. And the Buddha image represents that. The Buddha image represents, in a way, if we could bear the onrush of the angel, if we could be a bit like Leonardo's Virgin and just be with that kind of calm, we'd turn to look and the angel would be the Buddha. All of the fire would die down, all of the appearance would quieten away, and there'd just be this new vision of the Buddha. There'd be attuned beyond ourselves, there'd be spiritual rebirth. There'd be this superpersonal force that we're now, that's now working through us, which we become animated by. So the way we might access that is through our imagination. So what I want to do again is I'd like to finish by chanting the Shakyamuni mantra. So difficult to talk about this stage because you have to make an imaginative leap. That's the whole point. You can't think about it, you can't get there. You have to get to the edge of karma nirma processes. We need to be our best, our most receptive, our most positive, our most in touch. And then we need to leap beyond that. And in that leap, something new can arise. So what I'd like to do is finish by chanting the Shakyamuni mantra. As usual, when you're ready, just take your cushions and mats, put them down the sides, or mean people at the sides gradually moving away. But try and do that in touch with anything that this seminar has evoked. And then we'll be silent in this room, we'll just clear up in this room whilst chanting the mantra, and just go when you want it. And this mantra represents this suprapersonal force.